Welcome to Books, Stories, People with me, Nancy Richards. Hi there, I'm Nancy Richards. Welcome to Books, Stories, People, the podcast. So what's it all about? Well, it's all in the name, really. Books, shelves and shops full of them just waiting to be read. Stories, and don't we just all love them? And people. Now, there's an infinite source and variety of stories, if ever there were, right here locally and all over the world. But, you know, with all three, there's always so much more than meets the eye or the ear, more than we have time for very often. So what we're going to be looking at here are the backstories, the extra bits, the details, the stories behind the stories. You know, if you ask any author to tell you about their book, for sure there's going to be so much more to say. How they got there, what inspired them, what they left out, how it changed in the process, who they hurt in the writing of it. Plus, in terms of books, there's so much more to say than just about the finished hard copy. There's the editing, the cover, the design. There's a whole industry around books. It's a really rich subject. And any story, whether it's written or told, has almost certainly got more than just one angle, and more than likely a whole lot of history behind it too. And as for people, what can I tell you? You'll know for yourself just how many stories you have to share that you've never had a chance to because nobody ever asked you, or if they do, they don't give you a chance to finish it. You know, from the little things that may have happened in your day to the great big stuff, your history, your grannies, your grandparents, even one little thing from your past or your family's past, your memories, your moments, you have so much. So that's what it's all about, books, stories, people. And I hope you enjoy listening to all my book stories, people, as much as I do. And if nothing else, what I really hope is it inspires you to think about your own story or stories and the stories behind them. And my story? Well, you might well ask. I'm an independent journalist based here in Cape Town. I've done in print, up in radio, all sorts of things. But above all, what I really love are books, stories and people. And I hope you'll join me. Okay, Mervyn, I have absolutely no idea what your response is going to be, but I'm longing to know what you wanted to be when you grew up.
Unfortunately, it's a boring response in the sense that I had absolutely no idea. I was never one of those kids who at age 6 or 8 or 14 or even 18 went, this is what I want to do. And I remember being really envious of some of my classmates and their clarity. I also remember sort of convincing myself that my life would be more interesting because I wasn't on a very clear track to doing X, Y, and Z. But that was just trying to make myself feel better about being completely clueless about how I wanted to emerge into the world after school.
Well, there you go. So Mervyn Sloman is a very confused young man, but hopefully things have changed since then. But
a little bit.
Let me tell you about Mervyn Sloman. Mervyn Sloman opened the doors of the Book Lounge back in 2008, which was a very brave move to launch an independent bookshop back then. In fact, it was a brave move any time. But 12 years on, and against all odds, not least a global pandemic, the Lounge survives as one of Cape Town's favourite bookstores. It's unquestionably had an extraordinary impact on the reading habits of Capetonians and beyond, and appears almost to have grown its own book culture. So how and why? Let's get to the story of a bookshop. Mervyn, lovely to have you here, and thank you very much. And so I'm very sorry about you never really having any direction in your life as a child. So then I suppose the question is, what was the direction that led you to opening a bookshop?
Thanks very much for having me here, Nancy. It's lovely to chat to you as always. So straight from school, I went to varsity. The one thing I wanted to be in high school was a student activist. It was the sort of late 80s. It was the last period of high apartheid. And I was living a very kind of cloistered middle class, white privileged existence, and was kind of aware of injustice but felt completely removed from the reality of South Africa. So I went to varsity with the intention of trying to make a difference in some way, and that was reflected in that I switched between all sorts of different studying options and didn't study any of them particularly hard. was excluded from varsity for failing everything and not showing up to exams and all that kind of thing. Anyway, cut a long story short, my early adulthood in terms of sort of career and profession was a continuation of the confusion of younger Mervyn. I eventually went back to varsity later, did honours in political science, toyed with an academic career, and then got very frustrated with that environment, did various other things. At one point, I realized I had been working in bookshops sort of part-time while I was studying, and also at times when I was sort of between things and unemployed. Actually, the first job in a bookshop I had was in London. I went and ran away to London for 3 years, worked in a store there called Hammocks in Harrow, sadly now defunct like many other bookstores. And at a point when I was in, what was I, about 30 or so, I kind of realized that the only jobs that I'd ever enjoyed were working in bookstores. But I had been brought up to believe that that wasn't a career, that was something one, you know, did as opposed to waitering. And I remember sitting down with my wife, Annika, and just sort of talking about stuff. And she just looked at me and said, well, her words were possibly slightly more choice than this, but something along the lines of, for God's sake, Mervyn, go and get a job at Exclusive Books. But don't worry about money. I'll work like a dog for the next however long it takes, but you go and have fun in a bookshop. And so that's what I did. Went to work for EB, worked at various branches there for about 4 years, and probably from about a couple of years into that, probably about halfway through, I started having fantasies about opening my own place, about doing something a little bit differently. It took a while to kind of obviously get my head around that, do some planning, and then, at the beginning of 2007, I started getting very serious about it, looking for a space, trying to write a business plan, failing miserably at that, deciding who I didn't need a business plan. I did all sorts of things the wrong way, but through, I don't know, force of will and some very supportive people around me, managed to do it and found the space. My wife found the space, and we opened 1st of December 2007.
Yeah. By hook or by crook, or by book, I suppose. So you went from being a student activist to really being a book activist. You said a number of interesting things there, not least was that you, when you were at Exclusive Books, you had fantasies about doing it differently. Mm. Just to define the differently.
I think that I felt that there was space for something different. I think that I've got very little certainty about the world that we live in at the moment, and I think anybody who does, about the present and about the future, I don't trust that certainty. Where we were at that time, I remember feeling very strongly that there was space for big chain or more bookstores, whatever you want to call them, to coexist with small independent stores. And I felt that they could perform different functions. One of the things for me was around creating a space where people felt comfortable, it was welcoming, away from the sort of stresses and tension, which I think is rooted in malls, and a space where people feel comfortable browsing, having a cup of coffee, talking about books, engaging with each other and with us and all that kind of thing. Also, what was central to that initial sort of notion was a couple of other things. One was around building relationships with writers. And I remember in my early days at Exclusive Books being, and this is not about trashing EB, but about just having an experience where a writer came in and it was almost like everybody went hiding and trying to understand what was going on. And there was a sort of a general feeling that writers were put on earth to make our lives miserable. They were demanding. They wanted to know why you didn't sell more of their books. They wanted to know why their books were here and not there. And yes, there are some writers who can be like that, and I can understand part of that. But there was also a, you know, thing which went, but actually, without these writers, we wouldn't have these books and we wouldn't be selling and blah, 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 blah. So I thought it was important to build those relationships because I've got a hell of a lot of respect for people who actually write good books. It's not an easy thing to do. I've read enough bad books to know that the good books take something special. The other thing was when you have a big organization, a big company, a chain of shops, there are all sorts of sort of pressures or priorities which are sort of integral to the way the company is run. And I think that that's unavoidable. And so there'd be very clear things around, you know, we can't keep this book in stock because it doesn't sell quick enough. And there were probably formulas floating around about, you know, sort of stock turn and how many books per square meter and all that kind of stuff. And I'm, when it comes to books anyway, I was more of a romantic. I kind of like, there's this book, I think this book is fabulous, I want to have it on our shelves, I don't care if I only sell one every 3 years because it's a great book, you know, and I can't bear the thought of it not being available in our shop. At some point, reality kicked in, at that point where you've got to actually pay publishers for the books that you're buying from them, you know, and so you end up making all sorts of compromises. But at the same time, I think that there's a fundamental difference in ethos between an indie where you're running your own show and you can make decisions which don't make financial sense in terms of the corporate handbook, but feel right. You're working for a big company and it doesn't matter whether it's a chain of bookstores or anything else. You can't do that. You don't have the space to do that.
So writers are integral to the whole vision. That was to incorporate I'm sort of feeling writers and coffee are sort of integral to the whole vision, so that we were making a place that was welcoming for writers. But most important is to make it welcoming for readers. And you talk about choosing, you know, a book that you really love and you're going to have it on the shelves, like it or not. But one has to be real. One has to accommodate a different taste. When you started out with your beautiful building, we'll get to the location later, how did you decide what books that you were going to, you obviously worked with publishers, but how did you discern what was interesting for you and what might be interesting for the public at large?
It was actually a very interesting process. And I mean, I haven't thought about this for a long time, but you're taking me down memory lane here. So as I said, I'd been working in the trade for 4 years, and that was incredibly important. It was very useful in all sorts of different ways. I opened the shop with a lot of institutional knowledge. And I remember going through catalogs and talking to reps and publishers and discussing it with the team that I had, you know, put together, who were going to open the shop together with me. And we had a certain amount of money that, you know, that we could spend on those opening orders, on buying books. So we also had to be careful. And we opened up with, well, those opening orders were sort of a balance between what we knew, what I thought I knew would sell because of the environment that I came out of, because of my experience, my history in the book trade, because I know that those books sell. So a new book by James Patterson or a new book by John Grisham or what have you, and balancing that with things which we were passionate about. Very quickly, we found ourselves returning almost all of the books that you see a big pile of in the chain bookstores. We weren't selling them. The people who were coming to us were coming for other stuff. They were coming for the books that we were passionate about. That was our experience in the first 18 months, 2 years. It was also, it was very rewarding because obviously, I mean, you speak to any bookseller, what do they want to do? They want to sell books that they love. And it reinforced what we were trying to do and that part of the vision. As we grew over the years, there's been a little bit of a shift in balance. And there are some things that we sell which are similar to the things that you'll kind of, you know, see piles of in some of the other shops. But it hasn't shifted that much. A friend in publishing who every now and then sends me a list of the Nielsen figures, which are the, you know, sort of the aggregated bestsellers in the country as recorded by Nielsen. We're not part of that system. And invariably, I'll just sort of glance at it and go, you know, look at the top 15 bestsellers and there's maybe two of those which we've got in stock because we just can't sell them, which is interesting.
So what are you selling? So what are the ones that are floating to your top 10?
At the moment, what do we say? I just did yesterday, ran a report on our bestsellers of the year, well, bestsellers since March, basically looking at, you know, what we're doing since lockdown. Just out of curiosity, and Lauren Bjerkes' brand new novel Afterland is our bestseller for the last few months, which is no surprise. Lauren is an amazing writer, And I think Afterland is outstanding. There are a couple of sort of heavy-hitting international novels which are on that list. The Hilary Mantel, the latest one in the trilogy, has done extremely well. There's a book by Remy Ngamija called The Eternal Audience of One. I absolutely love that novel. We had Remy at Open Book last year. Probably four or five of my colleagues at the Book Lounge have all absolutely loved it as well. So the year, and that's, you know, sort of a year, a little bit more than a year since it came out. And that's because we love it.
Yeah.
You know, a collection that came out from Quella called Living While Feminist, which was a follow-up to Feminism, is from last year. That's also one of our top sellers. I think it's an incredibly important book. So it's a mixture. You know, out of that list, you would probably, I would guess you would find the Hilary Mantel on bestseller lists in other spaces. I very much doubt you'd find anything else from our top, probably top 10, featuring on anybody else's bestsellers, and vice versa. Mm.
Reading between the lines, so to speak, it sounds then perhaps less like you grew a culture rather than you were giving people what they actually wanted after all this time, that instead of them having to go to the corners of the big bookshops to find what they were wanting, you were giving it to them in droves. So you were doing a lot of listening, as well as you were telling people what you had, but listening to what it was that people wanted, and above all, listening to the writers. And just on the writers, it seems that, you know, I've sort of proudly said that you've grown a book culture. You've certainly grown a writer's network. Keep your writers very close to your heart. Is that deliberate, or is it just a happy coincidence?
Slightly uncomfortable with some of your wording there. feels like there's a little bit too much power and possibly manipulation. I feel like I'm keeping writers on a string, certainly not. Look, I'm very passionate about South African writing. I think that there is some very, very talented writers. I think that there... I suppose you're reminding me of something else, which is that how many people I would deal with in a chain bookstore, in exclusive books, customers I'm talking about, who, you know, ask for something for their book club or for themselves or what have you, and there would be, I don't want a South African book. And I'd actually forgotten about that because we moved so far away from that. And also feeling really angry and frustrated about that at the time. I think that there's different elements to this conversation, and part of it is around simply being the wonderful South African books, wonderful South African writers, and we should be promoting them. They're ours, they're our people. The more difficult conversation is around the transformation or lack of transformation of the industry as a whole, and how what is published in South Africa is still so incredibly skewed, how difficult it is for young black writers to get published. When I talk about this kind of thing, I also, you know, have to rein in the anger sometimes and just go, we do need to just take a breath. I need to take a breath and acknowledge that there has been movement, that it is better than it was 6, 7, 8 years ago. But wow, we've got a long, long way to go. And I've got some very, very good friends in the publishing industry, relationships that I've built up over the years, people I've got a lot of respect for. And they know and they understand that when I say we have to move away from the vast majority of publishers in this country looking like them, looking like me, being middle-aged white people, they know it's not personal. But as long as that is the case, we are going to continue to have an industry which is completely unrepresentative in terms of its output. And the other thing which I have constantly been banging on about is that, you know, having this conversation with publishers and decision makers and people in power 6, 7 years ago, for me, it was a political conversation. It was an ethical conversation. It was a philosophical conversation. That shifted. It became an economic conversation. There are so many young black people who want to read books by young black writers. They want to see themselves represented in literature. Understandably, that's something that people like you and I take for granted because it's always been there for us. And, you know, for every incredibly wonderful, successful novel like The Yearning by Mohale Mashego, there are people buying that, constantly buying that, who would like to buy another 10 of the same. And it's happening. It's happening slowly. There's some wonderful young black writers being published, but wow, can we kick that door down?
Well, you are certainly kicking that door on a regular basis, because one of the milestones in the journey of the, in the story of the bookshop, is that you opened up with launches, which brought in not just the people, but the writers as well. And just when we get up, before we get on to the launches, I just want to talk a little bit about the location, because one imagines with an independent bookshop that it would be this tiny little corner shop in a dusty place, you know, on a street where there's a butcher and a baker and this funny little bookshop. But actually, you've got quite a spacious location that you've had to fill with books, and you have filled with books. Just quickly tell me about the location of the building, when your wife found it. What were you looking for? Why did this one tick the boxes?
I was looking for somewhere in town, in the kind of CBD broadly. I just felt I wanted to be in town. I thought that was something important about not being in the suburbs somewhere. And partially that's about access and public transport and being in the heart of a city as well. And I'd been looking probably 6-7 months for somewhere, and just couldn't find the right space. And then, my wife came home one evening and said, you know, she's seen it. She's found the shop. And I was like, yeah, right. Anyway, so I came down and had a look the next day, and there was a sort of to let sign. And I mean, it's a beautiful building. I just looked through the window, and it was a sort of manky carpet, but thought, okay, there might be something nice underneath there. And I thought, yeah, it looks, you know, yes, it's lovely, but it's too small. Anyway, I arranged to go in and have a look the next day, and went in, and then there was a sort of weird kind of like hole in the floor. And I sort of went like, what's this? And there's just this sort of underground basement, which is, you know, sort of, you know, overrun and damp and whatever. And I was like, okay. And sort of stuck my head further down through the hole. And I was like, okay, no. We can do this, but I want the basement as well. And there's a very, very long and complicated story around the fact that the people who were showing me the property were actually leasing it and were not allowed to sublet to anybody else. And there was a whole drama which went on about, I thought the landlords knew about it, they didn't. Anyway, the whole thing almost just then went belly up. But at the last minute, we managed to work something out, and I met the landlords. So yeah, the fact that there was, I wasn't looking for this. I wasn't looking for two levels. I wasn't looking for a particular kind of building. But I'd seen a lot of places which were not going to work. And then when I saw that downstairs, something just popped, and I went, okay, we can do something interesting here. And there's enough space between the two floors to make something work.
Well, I wonder if the time when you put your head down that hole, if you envisioned that there would be sort of trays groaning with lovely snacks and wine where you would be having your launches, and how extraordinary that that's panned out that way. Coming back to the launches, that was a milestone. That sort of opened up a whole new way of selling books and of discovering books. Mm. What was the thinking? What was the outcome? What was the process?
A couple of things. So, I mean, it's not like we invented book launches. They had existed before us. But the majority of launches that I had sort of certainly seen in my time in the trade were a little bit of a kind of a celebratory party. Somebody would speak about, make a little speech about how wonderful the author was or the book was. And then the author would stand up and, I don't know, thank the grandmother's pet chihuahua for bringing them a pen, or, I don't know, some stuff, okay? And it always left me feeling incredibly frustrated because I felt like, you know, books are about storytelling. Books are also about conversations, ideas, and books are about content. And surely, if we're going to all this trouble to introduce a book to the world, what at least we can do is provide a bit of content along the way. So that was the one thing. Second thing was, I felt that, you know, if I read a book and I really enjoy it, then the thought of meeting the author or listening to the author speak is a, you know, wonderful one. You know, I think it's interesting and exciting. So we wanted to create events, make events central to what we were doing as a shop, as a means of providing access for readers to writers but also the other way around. It's a kind of two-way street. Not all writers enjoy it. Some writers absolutely hate it. Some writers don't like doing it, but a lot of writers do. And you can understand why. It's a, you know, an example. It's an opportunity to engage with people who are reading or could be reading their work. The other part of it is that a bookshop for me is it's a space that sells books, but it's also a space for ideas, for conversation, for discussion, for debate. And what the events do is that they create a framework in which I think really important conversations can happen. And there are some events that we have done over the years which have not been tied to a particular book or a book launch. For the most part, they're book related, but occasionally there's something else. And obviously, Open Book Festival allows us to, you know, do that in a different way as well. But that notion of a bookshop being a space for conversation was also central to that. The third thing is that, and that's part of those conversations, is that books are expensive. Books are there for the elite. They're there for middle-class people and above those who've got X amount of money. And I thought it was really important as well to try and use the space that we had to, where possible, open up those conversations so that people could come to an event at the Book Lounge, engage in a conversation without necessarily having the 200 or 300 or, in some cases, unfortunately, 400 rand required to actually buy the book. But that didn't exclude them from participating in the conversation around the book. I thought that that's something that's incredibly important, particularly in Cape Town, in South Africa. So all of that was part of the kind of vision starting. I never for a moment thought that we would end up doing so many events. I remember having a conversation, again, when we were opening the book, one of my colleagues, and we were talking about, okay, maybe what we should do is go every, I think we were saying every second Wednesday is event night, where we have a conversation around a book, or a book launch or something like that. And then I went, no, we can't do that, because then everything we do, we have to do to the best of our capability. And if we commit ourselves to doing something every 2 weeks, we're going to end up doing random things just to fill the space. So yes, at that point, I wasn't thinking that, you know, within a year we would be doing three or four launches a week. I had no idea that there would be such a demand and that people would respond so positively to it, because obviously the only reason we can continue doing them, or could continue doing them in a pre-COVID world, is that people turned up and they engaged and they made the events worthwhile. So yeah, there was an idea, there was a vision, but I underestimated how people would respond to it and how central it would become to our identity and how people saw the Book Lounge.
Yes, and I'm quite sure you underestimated how many people sort of stampede to the book when there's people that they want to hear the conversation behind the book, as you say. Mm. And it's such an enriching thing for anybody who is reading a book to hear what the writer has to say, because there's so many more layers, you know, the bits that weren't written, the difficulties around it. It's just a wonderful thing. So expanding on the appetite, the evident appetite that there is for this sort of thing, next came the Open Book Festival, which you skated over very quickly there, but actually that had become a huge event on the Cape Town calendar, on Cape Town's cultural calendar, if you like. What, very briefly, was your vision for it? And that, too, grew like Topsy, if I'm not mistaken. I think an idea, and then it took off.
Yeah. So Open Book, we started, this year would have been number 10. So first festival happened in 2011. It initially started as a extension of what we were doing with events at the shop. And obviously a festival format creates a space for you to do so much more than you can do in individual events where you bring a whole lot of writers together. So yeah, partially it was an extension of what we were doing. It was also, you know, based in, and I suppose, an understanding that international literary festivals had grown tremendously in number over the previous decade or so. It was something that wasn't reflected in South Africa. We had Franschhoek, the Franschhoek Literary Festival, which had been going, I don't know, for a few years when we started Open Book, but there was nothing in Cape Town. And I also thought it would be really important to do something in the city, to do a festival where people could engage with it in their lives, and that the content reflected that as well. And yeah, it was conceptualized as a partnership. There were a couple of other people who were, well, one other person was part of it, and then there was a UK festival we were working with, and then that all a few months before the first festival just blew up, and I ended up with this thing by myself. And it was a book launch project, so I mean it was fine. I wasn't completely by myself. And yeah, it is something that did grow over the years. It is something that, you know, we do up until this year. We've been doing last few years somewhere in the region about 140 different events over those 5 days. I think it has become a important space to both in the book world and in Cape Town sort of cultural and political life more broadly, in terms of the kinds of conversations that people have, in terms of the mix of people who show up and who are a part of the festival. You know, there have been a whole lot of things over the years where, you know, I've heard incidentally or people have mentioned to me about things that have come out of it in terms of people having met each other there, you know, and interesting projects and that kind of thing, which is something that's always gratifying to hear. So yeah, I mean, we've had a lot of support, which has enabled us to create that kind of space. Yes. What happens going forward? Who knows?
Who knows, indeed, this time. But a lot of those networks that you describe, those sort of interactions of between local and international writers, because a feature of the Open Book Festival has been to bring in more internationals. And the conversations that happen within that are just enormous. And it's such an opportunity for you to look at your constituency, to see who your clientele are, want of another word, and grow it. Talking of growing it, growing the reading culture, I think one of the things your personal CSI, if you like, has been to grow a reading culture amongst school children. And I know over the years you've worked with under-resourced schools. Is that something you feel very strongly about? Is it something that's part of what you are able to continue to do?
Absolutely. I mean, I think it's essential. I don't think anybody can make an argument around books not being important for kids. You know, I was very fortunate to grow up in a very privileged environment, and a big part of that was access to books both at home and at school. You know, my schools were well-resourced schools with lots of books in the libraries. The vast majority of schools in South Africa don't have libraries, don't have books. The vast majority of households don't have books. And those kids are, in my opinion anyway, at a massive disadvantage because of that. So, yeah, I mean, it's been a part of what we do, both at the shop and at the festival in different ways. We look at different things that we can do. It's a very limited intervention on our part. Intervention's putting it too strongly. It's a limited action. But we do what we can, you know, and for the last couple of years, we've been working with a school called Inchinga Primary, and we've been putting what we call open box into their classrooms. And we did grade R's and grade 1's last year. We're going to be doing the grade 2s and 3s this year and possibly moving up to the grade 4s. That's obviously on hold at the moment, like everything else is. But that's about working with the school, putting these, it's called an open box, but it's a big thing, which has got a whole lot of books in it and other sort of teaching resources and stuff like that.
Well, it's not nothing. I mean, no matter how small an intervention it is, it's something. And, you know, if one child gets one book that puts them on a path that is a major something. It's a starfish principle, isn't it? So talking of putting things on hold, briefly, the Open Book Festival, Quo Vadis, is it going online? Is it virtual? What are the plans?
No, is a short answer. There won't be any kind of Open Book Festival this year as such. We looked at possibly, you know, sort of doing some kind of digital festival, and there are various reasons why we decided not to do that. What we are doing, hopefully, is so the Book Lounge launched a podcast recently. I've done 3 episodes so far, and Fusty Carlitz, who's actually the new Open Book coordinator, has been running the Book Lounge podcast. And what we are hopefully going to pull off, we're sort of in the early planning stages of that, is a sort of Open Book takeover of the Book Lounge podcast and do a series of possibly 8 recorded and edited Open Book type events featuring writers who would have been at the festival this year, well, for the most part anyway, and then hopefully being able to edit and package all of those to get them out a little bit later than the festival would have been. So we're hoping to get that all out in October. That's the plan.
Watch this space.
Indeed.
Watch the website,
yeah.
booklounge.co.za.
Yeah.
There you go. Don't don't go anywhere else. And on the future, Mervyn, I mean, you know, who's got a crystal ball? Nobody knows. But, you know, the future of the reading world has been, you know, ever since the advent of digital, everybody's been sort of, oh, it's never going to work, you know, people don't read anymore. It doesn't feel like that. It feels like people are reading more. Two questions, really. How have people been reading over this COVID period? How has that impacted on people's reading habits? And then, you know, really, what do you see? I mean, it's the future of your bookshop. It's the future of the publishing industry, the writing industry. Start with the COVID experience.
I think what's been interesting is that certainly what we've been selling since just before lockdown, far more fiction than nonfiction. And I think that there are a few different reasons for that, I think. I think that certainly during the early parts of the lockdown, the sort of the hard lockdown, if you want to call it that, I think that there were a lot of people who do read fiction who suddenly had a little bit more time to do so. And the same way as they, you know, people who would maybe take 2 weeks holiday in December or Jan and come into the shop just before that and buy 8 novels. You know, it was those kinds of people who suddenly had this artificial space in the early part of the year to do that. I think that there's also definitely some people who would normally read nonfiction or would normally read both, who just wanted to get away from the world in their reading. I know I have really, really struggled to read any nonfiction. There's some things that I've picked up. There's some things which I kind of have to read for whatever reason. But I've really, really struggled. I tend to read more fiction than nonfiction anyway. But, yeah, I'm struggling with real. And I think that's because real is really, really hard right now. And so as much as we read for different reasons, we read to be entertained, we read to learn, we read to, you know, sort of understand the world better and all sorts of things, I think what a lot of people are going through right now, there's more, I need to be transported in my reading. And that goes to, that takes us down the path to fiction rather than nonfiction. The other thing is that we are selling, so since we reopened, we reopened in a different way. So our hours are shorter than they were in a pre-lockdown world. We are limiting the number of people in the store to kind of 4 at a time. And we're doing a lot of deliveries and we're really trying to push that as much as possible and increased, you know, what is available on our website for people to purchase digitally and that kind of thing. So trying to take books to people and also recommend stuff. What that does mean is that your sort of the books that you sell from people browsing are much less than before because you've got much fewer people browsing. So we're selling less of a range because of that. We are selling hardly any kind of expensive books. We're not selling art books or coffee table books or any of that kind of stuff. We have got people going, I loved this novel, I want something else. So that's what's happening at the moment. There's been some, you know, sort of relatively, you know, sort of relatively big nonfiction, which has been published recently, where it was selling 1, 2, 3. In previous times, we would have sold 20 or 30 of those.
So to my sort of second part of that question, really, do you see that this could be the way of the future? I mean, you talk about people wanting to be transported. What better way to be transported than through a book? And maybe transportation is what we're going to need in the future. How do you see people's reading habits and the industry generally? Big question, short answer.
The short answer is I don't know and I distrust anybody who speaks with any certainty about anything right now. I think that there are a lot of different elements to that to that question. One of those goes to how are we going to be living going forward. People talk about people talk about things like post COVID and post this and post that. I don't know what that is when it is, and I also don't think that there's a line which is going to be on the 14th of September or the 30th of November or the 6th of June next year, which is going to be the line where we post COVID. It's going to be a long tail and there are going to be things that are going to change fundamentally for a long time or forever. Trying to understand that is difficult. I mean, one of the things that's absolutely clear that you know, I mean, the changes that we've made in terms of, you know, taking books to people, trying to engage in different ways with people because we don't have events anymore. That's, you know, through social media, through email, through talking, all that stuff's incredibly important. Deliveries are incredibly important. That is central to the new model of what a bookstore needs to be. Linked into this, when one is talking about the future, is the number of people who do not have jobs, the number of people who maybe are freelancing and have got less income coming in, the number of companies that are folding. Has there been a day in the last 2 weeks where you haven't heard of another restaurant, bar, shop, retail space, which has gone, no, I can't do this anymore? And that is scary. You know, books are, as I said before, books are expensive, and we rely on enough people with enough disposable income to buy those books. How deep this goes, how deep the economic depression, recession, whatever you want to, you know, and the impact that has going forward, I don't know. If you ask me, do I think the book lounge is going to be around in a year or 2 years or 3 years? I go yes, but I'm not sure how.
We'll take the yes. I liked the yes. That was a good positive answer. Mervyn, it's been very interesting, and there's a lot more questions besides. But I was going to ask you, what are you presently reading? And I know that reading for you it's a job. It's not a hobby. It's something that you do all the time. You listed some very significant titles there that have recently come out. And I'm sure if I asked you what you're reading now, you'd probably give me a list from here till tomorrow. But what I really want to know is, rather in the same vein as what did you want to be when you grew up, can you remember the book that made a real impact on you, whether it was when you were very young or when you were older, where you thought, wow, this has meant something to me?
So when I was young, all those years ago, long, long time ago, I loved reading. And I don't, my memory is not one that I don't remember sort of, you know, when I was very young. I remember reading, there was a writer called Michael Hardcastle who wrote these random books, it's cringy, which were basically all about imaginary soccer teams, football teams. Okay, and because I was a sports nut, I loved those. I loved Agatha Christie. I liked bloody Dick Francis. Oh, it's embarrassing. All that kind of stuff, you know, detective stories. And then something happened in high school. Something, different kids respond differently to schools and the way English is taught. And suddenly reading became this dreadful thing that I had to do. I had to read set works and stuff like that. So I stopped reading. And then started reading nonfiction, you know, sort of after school and political stuff and whatever. And then while I was living in London, I was staying in a friend or an acquaintance's place. She was away for 3 months. So I was looking after her place, and she had the most amazing collection of books. And I just started randomly picking things up and started reading, and something just happened there. And the book that comes to mind from that period, which is, you know, I feel kind of cringy about this because I feel like, you know, I should be saying some kind of, you know, amazing African classic or whatever. There's a book called Essays in Love by Alain de Botton, who has written a lot of nonfiction. He's a sort of armchair philosopher. And this was an early book of his. It was actually a novel. And it was a novel about a relationship. And it was written in the most ridiculous structure, sort of numbered paragraphs. And it didn't make sense at all. And I just loved it. And there was something about its quirkiness, something about it not being the complete antithesis of what had been drummed into me at age 15, 16, 17 about what English literature with a capital L was. It just gave me a wake-up call. It was just like, okay, this is fun. I enjoy this. I love it. And that's why Essays in Love will always be in the book lounge, because it's a personal thing for me. Right now, if you want recommendations, I'll give you a whole lot. And it won't be Essays in Love. I've just read Britt Bennett's book called The Vanishing Half. She was going to be at Open Book this year. Ah, cry a little tear, but it is absolutely, absolutely stunning.
Give me the title again.
The Vanishing Half. It's about these two sisters, a small American town, two sisters who run away from home. And then they become estranged from each other. And the reason for that is one of them takes a decision to pass for white. And so, of course, there's no contact with her sister, who is black. It's beautifully written. I'm just getting goosebumps. And it is so resonant to South African readership as well. So,
yeah. Well, we'll take that as your top read of the moment, The Vanishing Half by?
Britt Bennett. Yes.
I'm sure, quite sure, that you have got a whole slew of other titles that you could recommend. But right now, Mervyn Sloman, I think you need to get back to the bookshop and do what you do best, which is sell and recommend books. And more importantly, read lots of wonderful books. It's been a real treat, Mervyn, and I'm going with your will the book lounge be there in another 3, 4, 5, 10, 15 years, and I'm going with your yes, because I think it will, because Cape Town needs the book lounge.
Thank you, Nancy, and it's been great chatting to you.